This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. All right, so this is our second podcast, which I'm going to dedicate to foreign policy because, whatever reason, I got a lot of foreign policy questions this month. So let's see. Here's one about India and Pakistan. You know, Pakistan clearly harbors Islamist terrorists. The intelligence forces in Pakistan train these terrorists, and then they go over to India. And they commit horrific acts of terrorism against India. And the connection with Pakistan and the fact that Pakistan harbors them and actually supports them is well known. And yet, the questioner says, why does the United States not allow India to basically do what is necessary to protect itself? Why is a country like Pakistan receive help from America and protection from America, in a sense? Well, it's because the United States has a horrific, suicidal, unprincipled foreign policy. It does not recognize Islamic totalitarianism as an enemy, and therefore it does not recognize the real threat to the United States. It plays what is called realpolitik. So it needs Pakistan's help, supposedly, in its fight in Afghanistan. Why we're still there in Afghanistan, I have no idea, particularly since we refuse to fight any kind of decent kind of war to destroy the enemy. Why not just come home? But anyway, we're there, so we need the help of the Pakistanis, so we're nice to Pakistanis, so we don't want the Indians to be bad to the Pakistanis. But even if we left, not only that, by the way, we give Pakistan a huge amount of money, we supply them with weapons, we have for a long time, and yet they're clearly hostile to the United States. So why do we keep doing it? We keep doing it again because of this pragmatic, unprincipled foreign policy that we have in the United States. We won't declare enemies. We won't identify enemies. We won't make the enemy suffer. We pretend that enemies are friends. Take Pakistan, take Saudi Arabia. Take countries that support the Islamic ideology, that teach it, train it, fund it. And, you know, we do nothing to prevent it. So we are fighting a pathetic war against a mirage, a pretend enemy called terrorism. That doesn't really exist. We refuse to name him. We refuse to name his ideology. We refuse to name the countries that support him. Pakistan would be one of those countries. And as a consequence, you know, we're just floundering. You know, we're not losing. And the only reason we're not losing the war is because the enemy lives in caves and has no weapons. But given that they live in caves and don't have weapons, we should be winning. But we're not winning. We're just floundering. I mean, just this last week, they shut down embassies in like 23 different countries because we tremble before Al-Qaeda. It is pathetic for the mightiest military power in human history to act the way that it does. We have a president who doesn't care one iota about American self-interest, about protecting America, about protecting American citizens, about protecting American lives. What he cares about is appeasing the Muslim world, appeasing the enemy, appeasing Pakistan, appeasing the worst countries in the world. And if he has to sacrifice Israel and India, America's allies, in the process, so be it. Who cares, right? This week, they've announced new peace talks between Israel and Palestinians. You know, that just means, you know, we've had a new round of a new ceremony in which we're going to sacrifice Israel to the Palestinians. And of course, we'll see if the Palestinians accept the sacrifice. In the past, luckily for the Israelis, the Palestinians have turned down the sacrificial animal that is Israel because the sacrifice wasn't big enough. So this all boils down to a pathetic, weak, and pragmatic, unprincipled U.S. foreign policy, which is driven by the ideology of pragmatism, which says there are no principles. You shouldn't act according to principles. You do what you can in the short run. You get away with what you can. And I was just at a university, of all places, in Guatemala, and I was asked by a political science professor there to give a talk on foreign policy to some students. And we had a small lunch event with some 15 students and a few faculty members. And I talked about my views on foreign policy and what a principled approach where the government's only job is to protect the individual rights of Americans, and what the relationship there of that government would be in terms of foreign policy. The fact that we wouldn't engage in other people's wars, we wouldn't have humanitarian missions, we wouldn't be supplying foreign aid at all to anybody, including Israel, by the way, nobody. And instead of that, all we would do would use our troops to defend ourselves and to crush our enemies and come home. And at the end of the session, I mean, the professor seemed really intrigued and interested, but he said, you know, what you said today doesn't appear in any textbook. There's no theory in political science that supports what you say. There's no, in international relations, nobody teaches this stuff. Nobody, there's no, again, there's no academic literature about this. Nobody's ever heard of this stuff. Principles? How can you have principles in foreign policy? Self-defense? How can you define self-defense? How can you define self-defense? Crushing an enemy? You can't say that. That's not politically correct. You can't put that in a textbook. So everything they learn is the Kissinger school of foreign policy, which is pragmatism, pragmatism, pragmatism. Pragmatism doesn't mean practical. It means not thinking long-term and avoiding principles at all cost. So I've got a couple of questions here, one about Muslims in the UK and one about Muslims in the United States. And the question really is, you know, particularly in the UK, you know, there's this horrific murder by two Muslims of the soldier in London a couple of months ago. Just vile. And as a consequence of that, there were a lot of kind of anti-Muslim acts by kind of right-wing English people, I guess. And the general sense, at least of a number of people who asked questions here, is that the British government is protecting Muslims. And why is this? And aren't all Muslims the enemy? And isn't Islam the enemy? And shouldn't we be clamping down on all Muslims in the United States and so on? So let me try and articulate my position here. And look, my position is different than others. I know there are people in objectivism who disagree with me on this, but, you know, so be it. We disagree. I think I'm right, and I think they're wrong. We're still friends, though, in this case. I don't think all Muslims are bad. I don't think Islam qua religion is necessarily leads to violence and to radicalism and to a totalitarian agenda and to terrorism. I think they are westernized Muslims, just like they are westernized Jews and westernized Christians. I think all religion, qua faith, ultimately leads to violence. But some religions, Judaism and Christianity, have been pacified by secularism. They've been pacified by the Enlightenment. I think some Muslims have been pacified as well, and therefore not a threat. So I don't think that the target, we should kick out all the Muslims from the United States or kick out all the Muslims from England. I do think, on the other hand, that because all the terrorism against the UK and in the United States emanates from Muslims, that they should be profiled, they should be screened. It's okay to discriminate in terms of intelligence gathering. They should be monitored in a way that if you're not Muslim, you shouldn't be monitored. The NSA should be listening to some of their phone calls. They shouldn't be listening to anybody else's. So is a level of suspicion. And they, the Muslim communities who are indeed westernized, should accept that. They should accept that as, yes, people within our midst are committing horrific terrorist acts. It's our responsibility to help the authorities catch them because we're against them. And therefore, we're willing to help and we're willing to participate in this. I think airports should screen, I think so on. But I think it's also wrong to go out and burn mosques and go out and attack Muslims just because they're Muslims. You should not be initiating force against people you do not know are guilty. And this is what a government is for. A government is there to protect you. So what we need are governments that are willing to call the enemy what it is, Islamic totalitarianism, Islamism, Islamic fascism, however you want to call it, and then be willing to screen Muslims that live in that country for those tendencies. Anybody who is actively advocating for violence should be prosecuted for advocating for violence, should be kicked out of the country or put in jail if they're truly advocating for violence. Those who would just hold those ideas but not advocating for violence should be monitored. They should be monitored carefully by the security forces. And other Muslims should accept the fact that they will be profiled and they are much more likely to be scrutinized by intelligence services going on. So I think we need to identify the enemy. But there's another component to this. And I keep repeating this in a lot of my answers about foreign policy because this is important. We're at war with Islamic totalitarianism. We could win this war. We need to fight the war. We need to destroy the countries and organizations that support them, which means we need to support the supporters and funders and trainers and backers of Islamic totalitarianism. There are two countries in the world that do this predominantly, and that's Iran and Saudi Arabia. We should make those countries crumble, and they should be at a point where they will never, ever support this cause. You know, once you do that, you could go after Hamas and Hezbollah and the Islamic Jihad and the various Islamist organizations out there in the world. They won't last long because they can't last long without the funding from these Islamic countries. So if you take care of the countries and you take care of these organizations, then you won't have an Islamic problem domestically. It will go away. Once they believe that they are fighting for a lost cause, they will stop fighting. People don't want to die for nothing. They want to die because they believe in something. If America stood up and just asserted itself a little bit, just claimed the superiority of Western values and was willing to really crush its enemy, this would go away. This is a kind of pathetic war that could be won in a few weeks if we had the backbone to win it. And none of the issues about Muslims inside the country would even come up. But it's because we refuse to fight it. It's because we refuse to identify the enemy. It's because we languish in these countries who are winning wars. And we try to bring them democracy and bring them food and bring them sewer systems and bring them hospitals instead of actually fighting to win. It is because of that is our weakness that makes them possible. Without us being weak, none of this would happen. England wouldn't have a Muslim problem. The United States wouldn't have an Islamic problem. You know, this would all go away. So here's a quick question about Guantanamo Bay. Why do people oppose it? Don't they understand that these are POWs that are engaged in a war with us? And why do they want to treat them like criminals? Well, because we haven't declared war. You know, right after 9/11, Congress should have declared war. But to declare war, they would have had to identify the enemy. You can't declare war on terrorism. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's declaring war on a tactic. That's like the war on drugs, which is a war on an inanimate object. How's that going? Or a war on poverty. Wars on poverty can't work. You can't have a war against something amorphous and meaningless. You can only have a war against another country, you know, that motivated by a particular ideology that you have to name, so you know when it's defeated. So everything about this war is confusing, misleading, unintelligible, and it's because we refuse to name it. It's because we're politically correct cowards. We don't have a backbone. We won't name anybody. We've bought into multiculturalism. Who are we to declare another ideology inferior to ours or an enemy of ours? Who are we to have an ideology to begin with? Who are we to believe in freedom or to believe in anything? So we can't advocate for what is positive. We can't identify the negative. So, yeah, so terrorism, as a lot of people after 9/11 claim, that's just a crime. It's just a few people. We need to arrest them. We need to put them in jail. We need to try them like in a civil court. There's no war here. And again, this is the Bush administration's fault. They should have declared war. They should have declared war. They should have defined who the war was against. They should have defined what victory looks like. And again, if you want more detail on the way I believe the war should have been handled, what should have happened after 9/11, how the war should have been fought, how we could win, I strongly recommend Winning the Unwinnable War. That's Winning the Unwinnable War. We can find it on Amazon. It was edited by Ilan Juno, who's a fellow here at the Ayn Rand Institute. I have 3 essays in that book, but the book as a whole gives the answers to most of these foreign policy questions.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's 2 most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.